probably my favorite color pattern of all time is a bumblebee called Bombus rufo-fasciitis, or fasciatus, which I've never seen in person because it lives in the Himalayan mountains and in Kashmir. But I've seen a dead one, and it has this amazing, gorgeous color pattern of oranges and yellows and whites and reds. And I just think it's like the most beautiful bee. And it's on like my bucket list to see it alive someday in the field.
This is Science for the People. I'm Carolyn Wilkie, a science writer at Science News for Students. I'm absolutely buzzing with excitement over this episode because today we're talking bees. Every so often, I'm lucky enough to catch wind of a science project that I really have to share. That's the case with the topic of this week's show and the research of my guest, Michelle Duenis. Michelle is a professor of biology at St. Vincent College in La Trobe, Pennsylvania. She studies bumblebee ecology, nutrition, genetics, and conservation. I met Michelle in 2017. For a story I was reporting, I tagged along with her as she caught bees in this beautiful, flower-filled meadow. That was part of an ambitious study of bumblebee health and how it's impacted by pesticides, nutrition, and climate change. That summer, Michelle visited dozens of sites in the Sierra Nevada mountains and collected over 700 bumblebees, which she'd flash freeze and take back to the lab to analyze. She's also done some pretty neat work on bumblebee colors. Michelle takes her passion for bees past her research and onto the roller derby track. She skates for the Steel City Roller Derby in Pittsburgh. As she races around, she goes by her skater name, Polly Nader. But Michelle also mascots for the team as Derby, dressed, of course, as a bee. Thanks for joining me, Michelle.
Yeah, no problem.
So let's start with a super basic question. Why do you study bumblebees?
So I think it was 2007 when all of the news reports started coming out about colony collapse disorder. And I was like, oh, I really love bugs and I want to go to grad school to study bugs. So I'm going to save the bees. But then I got to grad school and I did one rotation in May Barenbaum's lab looking at honeybee nutrition. And then I did another rotation in Sydney Cameron's lab looking at bumblebees. And she just really like sold me on bumblebees. They're so big and so fluffy and so cute. And she already had this like small project going, studying bumblebees in Mexico and Central America. And she said, oh, you know, this is just a really small project, but you could expand this into a project. And I really fell in love with the idea of getting to travel and study these fluffy creatures. So that's when I really fell in love with bumblebees. And like over time, I've just like slowly been like becoming more in love with them. The more I learn about their biology, like they can live in crazy places like the Arctic, and they have all these amazing color patterns. I just love everything about them.
Yeah. And we'll definitely talk about a whole bunch of that stuff. I think before we get into the work that you've done, I am wondering if there are any super common misconceptions people tend to have about bumblebees, things that it'd be really good to like right off the bat just address.
Oh, the most common one is that bumblebee is just a species. Most people think that bumblebees are just one species of bee, and a lot of them think that carpenter bees and bumblebees are the same thing. But there's at least 250 species of bumblebees worldwide. I see there's this one article that I've been seeing passed around a lot on the internet that says that the bee has been named the most important creature on Earth or something. And the whole article, I can't remember where I saw it, and the whole article just refers to bees as if they're like one species. But there's at least like 20,000 different species of bees worldwide.
Oh my goodness. So
that's probably the most common conception is people are always surprised when I tell them that there's more than one bumblebee species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I really want to talk about the Sierra Nevada Bumblebee Health Project. I mentioned for listeners in the intro that I got to watch you catch and collect these bumblebees in the field. And it seems like you had this huge gargantuan project to just collect hundreds of them. Do you mind sharing what the goal of that work was? What were you trying to learn?
Yeah. And so that project's still ongoing now. And we are trying to use all of this biological information information that we can collect from bumblebees in the wild and see if the biological information that we collect from them can tell us a little bit about their health and how they might be responding to the effects of climate change, specifically in the Sierra Nevada in California. And part of the project was I collected bees really high up in the Sierra Nevada. I think the highest I went was 2,300 meters, which I'm really bad at math, so I don't know how many feet that is. Maybe. Well, really high in elevation. That's really isolated. So, you know, we assume that it's a more slightly more pristine environment. And then I also collected them like at the base of the Sierra Nevada in the Central Valley, where it's really agriculturally intensive. It's really, really hot down there. So you find bumblebees really only at the beginning of like March and April. And then they're gone because it just gets way too hot. And there's certainly not nearly as many different types of flowers for them to feed on down there. So I collected along this like gradient of elevation, but also land use to see if there were any differences in the bee populations at these lower elevations that have a lot of agriculture versus these higher elevation sites that are very pristine and have lots of different types of flowers they can feed on.
Ah, okay. So, and what were those what was the biological information that you were trying to get from them? What exactly were you looking at?
So one of them is looking at the genes that they're expressing, and specifically the genes that they're expressing in their brains. So last summer, I went back out to UC Riverside and dissected all these brains out of these bees, which is not, well, for me, in terms of insects, bumblebees are pretty large. So like if you're, you know, of like all the insects you could dissect brains out of, they're probably the easiest, but dissecting brains is not very easy. But the in their brains are expressing a lot of genes that that are then signaling to other organs in their body how they should respond to things they're encountering in the environment. So like if they eat a pesticide, those pesticide, like specifically, you might have heard of neonicotinoid pesticides. They've been in the news a lot lately. They affect the nervous system of insects because they're relatives of nicotine. And so if they're affecting the nervous system, there's also going to be brain signals involved in that. So you can see brain genes that are being expressed in response to eating something toxic in the environment, or brain signals are related to insulin and processing sugar. So it's going to be brain signals related to nutrition too. So looking at the genes that they're expressing in their brains in response to their environment, good and bad things in the environment.
Yeah. So that's, when you say that they're expressing genes, you mean that certain genes are active and that can tell you about what's going on in their bodies or what's going on in their brains?
Yeah, yeah. So you might expect maybe a bee that might have eaten some pesticides in the environment to, you might hypothesize that like that bee would have more detoxification genes being expressed than a bee that hasn't been encountering pesticides in the environment. Or a bee that's getting really, really good nutrition might be having different genes involved in breaking down sugars and signaling to the rest of their organs that they should be breaking down sugars. They might have different gene expression patterns than a bee that's got really poor nutrition.
Ah, okay. So it kind of helps you zoom in really close to what's actually going on in the
brain. Yeah. And then the other thing that we did the brain, the bee's brains, and we did two different species of bees, Bombus vosnesenskii, which is the yellow-faced bumblebee, and then Bombus melanopagus. I think the common name is the black-tailed bumblebee. I usually call it the black-butt bumblebee. And then we also collected pollen from each bee. So when I think I did this when we were out in the field together. After I'd stunned the bee, I scraped the pollen off of their legs. And then what we did is we submitted that one of those pollen. So they got two legs that they collect pollen on. The pollen from one leg was sent off for what's called metabolomics. So it's like doing a huge nutrition profile of all the stuff that's in the pollen. So like lipids, proteins, these things that are called secondary metabolites that some plants make, looking at all that stuff that might be in the pollen. And then the pollen from the other leg of the same bee, we sent off to sequence the DNA in it to identify the actual plant species that were in it.
Ah, okay. So you were trying to get an idea of the nutritional value in the pollen, and then also making sure you knew what plants they were in the first place.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Can you say a little bit more about catching the bees and stunning them and how, yeah, just what you would do when you were out in the field on any given day?
Yeah, so I would show up to a field site and I was trying to get 20 samples total from each of my field sites. So I had like really good replication. And so I'd show up and I'd set up my office, which was basically a table. And sometimes I got a tent later on because I was getting really sunburned, but I'd set up like my mobile processing office, which was like a collapsible table, a liquid nitrogen tank, and then like my deck chair. And I'd set that up next to my truck. And then I'd go out and catch bees. And I'd try to, as soon as I'd catch 5 bees, and I didn't want them to get too hot in a tube, because the thing with studying gene expression is it can change really quickly. So if I got a bee super stressed and hot inside of a tube, it might start expressing a bunch of heat shock genes that have more to do with it being hot inside the tube I put it in rather than what it was dealing with the environment. So I catch 5 bees and I run back to my table, and then I would put the tube like for just a few seconds into the liquid nitrogen, and that would cool, basically put them to sleep. They're not dead, but it just puts them to sleep so that then I can identify what species they are and scrape off their pollen loads. And then while they were asleep, I do that and then put the pollen and the bee back in the liquid nitrogen to kill it.
Mm-hmm. And then you would take them back to the lab for whatever, for I guess, brain dissections.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I think, I'm not sure if we've mentioned this so far, but how many bees did you end up collecting for that project?
777 bees total from 2 different species, the Bombus melanopius and Bombus vozinsensikii.
Ah, yeah. And what have you ended up learning so far? Or what have you learned so far from the project?
So far, because of that delay in the funding, we had to put a little pause on the project for a little bit, but we were able to get metabolomics data, and we're seeing really cool differences in the nutrition that the Bombus melanopagus is feeding on versus the Bombus vozinsensikii, which is really, really cool. And we can kind of see, and we think it might be related to the plant species that they're feeding on. So, So in some places where I caught the bees on really similar flowers, it looks like they're collecting the similar kinds of the pollen in their legs had similar nutrition profiles. But then I would collect them at different sites on different flowers and the nutrition profiles would change completely. And so it does seem to really matter what actual flowers they're visiting, because each flower has a really different nutritional makeup. And we're hoping that we may be able to, with the DNA sequencing of the pollen, match the nutrition of the pollen to the actual species that they're feeding on and see if those match up to each other.
Ah, okay. So you're able to, at least so far, you can tell that their nutritional profiles are, you know, sort of linked to what it is that they're eating, even across bee species. Is that a good way to sum it up?
Yeah, that's a great way.
Okay. And then I guess what other data are you hoping to get out of the project? What else do you have left to learn?
So we still have to, we sent off all the RNA, which is the expressed genes in the bees. After I extracted that, we sent it off to a sequencing center. So we're waiting to get that data back and see how the genes they're expressing might correspond to the nutrition in the environment. And then we're also hoping to look at their guts and see if there's any differences in the parasites and the pathogens that they have in their guts in the high altitude versus the low altitude.
Ah, okay. So is that a common problem that bumblebees have as far as health? Something that affects...
Oh, yeah. And that's some work that I've worked on when I was still at the University of Illinois. Is specifically one parasite that I looked at was Nosema bombi. It's not a fungus, but it's closely related to fungi. It's called a microsporidian parasite, and it can be really, really bad for bees if they get it. It basically gives them like a version of bee dysentery.
Oh,
and
no.
Yeah, it's really bad. And one of my collaborators, Jamie Strange, who's now at Ohio State, he found that bumblebees that have really high infections, males specifically, they get so fat and engorged with this parasite that they can't actually even mate with the females anymore. So that's like one parasite that we know can have really dramatic effects on bumblebees in their health. But there's lots of other parasites that affect them too.
Yeah. So it sounds like that one's a major example of like a life cycle disruption. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And then if I recall, you were also looking at pesticides that were on the bees themselves or on the pollen. Is that right?
Yeah. So we're hoping also, not sure how we're going to do it yet. Is to also look and see if the bees have pesticides in them themselves too. And if they have been exposed to pesticides in the field, how are maybe their genes responding to that?
Okay. Yeah. The last thing I wanted to ask about related to this work was, it's also tied into climate change, right?
Yes.
And so, what questions are you exploring with regards to how climate change might be affecting bees' health, and how are you doing that?
So mostly we're thinking about climate change in a very specific way, in the way that it has affected California and the Central Valley. So there's been long, long periods of drought in California, which we both know from living there. And that's just one consequence of how climate change has affected California. So specifically looking at how those differences in water availability in the Central Valley and up high in the Sierras might be related to bumblebee health. And then also agriculture and high industrial agricultural scenarios. They're not really a separate problem from climate change, because they kind of intensify it, especially when you plant these huge monoculture crops and you limit the food availability and the plant diversity in a region. You're directly feeding into climate change and then also carbon emissions that come from agriculture. So looking at kind of the synergistic interactions between agricultural intensification and climate change with each other.
Okay. And then you're looking at how that will affect bees' nutrition through their nectar and pollen. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Yeah. So some of those results we're going to have to wait a while for, because your project's on hold because the USDA office moved to Kansas City. Do you want to talk a little bit about how that decision has impacted the science that you do?
Yeah. This project has basically been on hold for about a year because of that relocation. So Sonny Perdue was the recent appointee to head the USDA, and he decided to move a few of the USDA agency's headquarters to Kansas City, Missouri, instead of Washington, D.C. And the rationale behind that was to move them out there so that they would be closer to farmers. One of those agencies that he decided to move was NIFA, which is the National Institute of Food and Agriculture. And that is who my grant funding is currently coming through. But with that move, I think the number is 92% of employees either left or were fired with that move.
Oh, wow.
And so for about a year, there just was literally no one in awards management to process the conversion of my grant. So I left University of California, Riverside, because I got a faculty job at St. Vincent College. And so I was in the process of trying to move that money from UC Riverside to St. Vincent. And it just was really bad timing, because that's also when they moved the agency and reduced it dramatically in size. And so for about a year, there's just literally been no one to even, no one's been home to even process the conversion. So, and we couldn't access the money because it was back at USDA. So we just kind of had to sit and wait for the money to come back. But we got an award notification this week. So the money's back, finally.
Hooray. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's like a real example of how, you know, this sort of regulatory decision or something can impact science that scientists do. Yeah.
Yeah. And the brains that I got, so we were out there together in 2017. And then I went back last summer to dissect out all the brains and extract the RNA from them. And then they just kind of sat in an ultra cold freezer for about a year waiting for the money to come through so that we could actually sequence all the genes.
Okay. So more results are on their way though.
Yeah. Yeah. Finally. I'm so happy it finally got processed.
Let's talk about some of the work that came before this. So you've also done a lot of work with bees in the lab. And I'm just curious what it's like to work with bumblebees in the lab, what it's like to raise colonies, and some of what that work explored.
Yeah, so part of this grant was doing paired field studies, but also working with bees in the lab to kind of simulate smaller controlled studies. So out in the wild, we don't, you know, I don't really know what's happened to these bees before I collect them. But in the lab, we can simulate specific scenarios to see how it affects their gene expression and then compare these highly controlled experiments to what we see in the wild and try to infer from that what might have happened to them. So there were some experiments that we ran where we fed them. The main point was to give them two different pollens of different nutritional qualities, one from a flower that had lower contents of fats and proteins and one that had higher contents of fats and proteins, and see how it affects queens and how well they're able to establish nests. And to see how those two differences in nutritional profiles might affect their ability to start nests. And the one that had the pollen of lower nutritional quality had kind of like a delayed start in their nests, and their young developed a little bit slower than the pollen with higher nutritional quality. So it kind of, what we saw in the bees in the lab is that it looked like their development was moving a little bit slower on a lower quality diet rather than a higher quality diet.
Ah, okay. And that probably makes a big difference for the success of their colony, or?
Yes. The tricky thing about working with a social organism like bumblebees is that, like, if you're trying to figure out how well they are being able to go from one generation to the next, it's tricky because the workers don't actually produce most of the offspring. They may make eggs that will sometimes make males. So that's the other thing that's tricky about bees is that males come from unfertilized eggs and females come from fertilized eggs. And then on top of that, the workers don't actually make most of the offspring. Their ovaries aren't developed and they don't mate, so they can lay male eggs. And so they will contribute like males to the next generation, but they can't make queens, which are the egg making baby makers of the bees.
Oh, wow.
So
that's so weird.
Yeah, it's really, yeah. And it adds like this layer of complexity on trying to figure out like how, like, so if something affects the health of the workers, it's going to indirectly affect the health of the whole colony. not directly because they're not the ones that are actually contributing to the next generation, but they are the ones that are feeding all the babies, right? So if something inhibits the way that they feed all their sisters, that's going to then ultimately affect how many individuals then make it on to the next generation.
Ah, okay. And actually, that is a pretty good segue into something else that I wanted to ask you about. One thing I learned from you when we met was I actually didn't know much about the life cycles of bees and didn't really know that queens are these sort of like enterprising creatures that strike out on their own and start these colonies. Do you mind sharing a little bit of what that's like? You know, how, when that happens in the year and what the process is?
Oh, yeah, sure. And it's a little different depending on what part of the country you're in. Down in Southern California in Riverside, this whole process, like the whole life cycle of a bumblebee colony is like scrunched all into like 2 months because there's just not flowers and it's too hot for them the rest of the year. But this is kind of more drawn out and considered like the quote unquote more normal life cycle where I am in Pennsylvania, just because we have a much longer period of flowers available. But basically what happens, so like in Pennsylvania in the fall, in like probably October and maybe even also into November, what the colonies start producing what are called gynes, and those are the going to be the queens for the next year. So they go out and they mate with male bumblebees in the fall, and then what they do is they go and they collect and eat a lot of food because they need to build up their fat bodies, which is this basically an organ that kind of functions, well, a lot like fat in humans, but also kind of like their liver because they kind of use it to detoxify stuff. They got to make that really big and fat because they need to store up a bunch of nutrition reserves to survive the winter. So they go out and they mate. And then they eat a lot of food so that they can get big and fat and healthy to survive the winter. And then what they do is they dig into the ground and find a good place to hibernate. And so for about 3 months, they'll hibernate by themselves as a single queen in a little hole in the ground. And then when it becomes warm enough again, they'll come back out, and that's when they actually start a new colony of their own. They've already mated in the fall. So they're ready to already start laying eggs. So they'll go out and they'll find a place where that's suitable for their nest. And that can sometimes be like under a grass pile or in an old rodent's nest, or sometimes the crawl space of your house or under your deck. One time I got a call when I was still in California to get a bumblebee colony out of somebody's hot tub.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they'll just find any crevice that's kind of like stable enough and big enough to support like a growing colony, they'll nest in there. And so once they pick that spot out, and I actually saw queens doing this in my yard yesterday, is you can kind of spot a nest searching queen because one, she's huge. She's like, can be like an inch and a half long. And two, she's not visiting flowers. She's kind of zooming around really low to the ground and checking out holes. And so they'll like land and maybe they'll crawl into some rocks. And then you won't see them for a while, and they'll be like, oh, no, that wasn't a good spot, and they'll fly back out. And so you can, like, people could go out in their yards right now if they're in, like, the eastern United States and look for these queens that are buzzing real low to the ground and trying to find a suitable place to nest. And once they figure that out, then they'll lay some eggs, and they'll make a pot. And what they do is they make this single pot that they fill up with nectar and pollen, so that they can just basically sit and incubate their eggs for a couple weeks.
Ah.
So if you see a bumblebee right now, if you go out in your yard and you see a bumblebee and she's got big pollen loads on her legs, that means she's found a good place to start a nest. And now she's building up all those, all that nutrition so that she can incubate and sit on her eggs for a couple weeks. So then bumblebees kind of disappear for a little bit while you're waiting for those eggs to develop in the queens are sitting on them. And then as soon as those develop into that first group of workers, then they're the ones that are going to take care of their sisters. And then the queen just kind of becomes an egg-laying machine. So now she's not leaving the hive or the colony anymore. She's just laying eggs. And the workers are responsible for going out and collecting nectar and pollen to feed to the new developing larvae. And so then the colony will build over the spring and get bigger and bigger. And mostly you'll just see workers out. And then once it gets to the fall again, then that's when they start making the males and the gynes and they start the whole process over again.
Okay. But the whole fitness of that colony kind of depends on the first, on the queen.
Yeah. The whole fitness of the colony depends on her surviving that overwintering period and then also being able to get plenty of nutrition when she comes out from overwintering. So early blooming flowers that are out right now, and that's going to depend on where in the country you live here. Actually, one flower I've been seeing around here in Pennsylvania that queens seem to like is called dead nettle. It's a European invasive species, but I haven't personally been taking it out of my yard since the bumblebee queens seem to like it. But it's really important for like bumblebee success that there's flowers out really early in spring for them to feed on.
Okay. Another part of your previous work that you shared about was bumblebee colors. And so I think a lot of people think of bees as just being like yellow and black. But you shared with me that bumblebees can actually be really colorful with these oranges and reds and whites, white stripes. So what do these stripes actually mean?
So there's this idea in biology of aposematism, and that is that there's animals out there with really bright contrasting stripes that tell a predator, hey, if you eat me, you're going to get hurt. So with bees and wasps and other things, that black and yellow signal is kind of like a big bright warning sign to predators that if they eat something that is those colors, they'll probably get hurt. And how they learn that is they eat something like that for the first time. So usually it's like young birds or other predators. They'll eat that. They get stung and they're like, oh boy, okay, I'm not going to eat anything that's got these bright yellow, black, or orange stripes on it again.
Okay. But then these stripes can actually be really specific to certain populations. And that's what you studied, right?
Yeah. So I was, what I was looking at for part of my dissertation at the University of Illinois was mimicry patterns. So this other phenomenon that biologists have seen, even like, you know, into the early 1800s, biologists noticed that butterflies specifically kind of in one geographic area all kind of have very similar patterns. And the idea is that they have all these similar patterns, so predators don't have to learn multiple signals to not get eaten. And sometimes you can find like animals that are safe and not toxic at all are mimicking ones that are toxic. So there's a lot of ones that are really common around here in the United States are hoverflies. They're very commonly mistaken as bees. And actually, I just saw my Facebook memories this picture that I posted of the Secret Life of Bees DVD had a picture of a hoverfly on it and not a bee.
Oh,
because
no.
Somebody mistook it as a bee. So they're very convincing bee mimics. And the whole idea is that the bees come out, the predators eat them, they get stung, and then the flies come out and they're like, hey, I'm a bee, please don't eat me. So some of them are not dangerous. But with bumblebees, what I was studying were these what are called Müllerian mimicry. So it's all this stuff that's toxic and can hurt you that converges on one common pattern so that predators only have to learn one thing to not eat.
Okay.
And so we're trying to see if there's any common elements in certain geographic areas of these color patterns.
And what was that process like? I think I read or you told me that you actually drew hundreds of bees by hand. Like, why did you have to draw them?
Yeah, so it was kind of a really long process of figuring out how can we accurately and in a standardized way represent the different colors of all these bumblebees from around the world. And so we tried doing some imaging at first, but of dead bee specimens, but they're very three-dimensional. And sometimes they're abdomens curl up under them, and sometimes they don't, and sometimes they're bigger, and sometimes they're smaller. And so it was really hard for us to standardize those images trying to look at these elements. And so basically what we came up with was a template that was kind of like a coloring book. So I drew like a standardized bumblebee thorax, which is the middle part of their body, and then a standardized bumblebee abdomen. And that was kind of like my coloring book template for drawing each of the individual color patterns on the bees. And then I just took some museum specimens of every bumblebee species we could find. I think it was like 222 species. And then I drew multiple individuals of those species. So I think I drew over 500 individual bumblebees, and I used a standard template of color pencils to represent each of the colors that I was seeing in the bees.
And what did you learn from that?
Basically what we found is that if you try to look at all these elements across all these bees, there seem to be these standard pieces of the bee that are changing in different parts of the world. So another part of this project was not only like looking at these mimicry complexes across the world, but also trying to understand what might be the evolutionary development of these color patterns. So what might be the genes that are controlling the expression of these different colors? So a lot of this work was inspired by work that was done on butterflies by Frederick Nyout, where he tried to classify the patterns that were on the wings to see if we could get an insight into the development and the genes that were being expressed to create all these variable patterns across wings. By just, kind of trying to figure out how you classify all these different patterns. And what we found is that most of the elements that make up all the color patterns that you see around the world, for the most part, correspond to the body segments that they already have. So it's a really simple plan that bumblebees have compared to like all the spots and eye patterns that you see in butterflies. And what's my favorite thing is that, I really like this project because I really love art, and just getting to draw bumblebees for science every day was just, I never took advantage of that, and I love doing it so much. But also, Heather Hines has been doing a lot of really amazing experiments. Heather Hines is a student with me of Sydney Cameron's at Illinois, and now she's a professor at Penn State, has been doing these awesome studies of color genetics in bumblebees, and has found that a lot of these genes that are involved in just like the basic body template of a bumblebee are also responsible for all these crazy color patterns that you see around the world. And so this kind of confirming what we have seen from me drawing all of them with colored pencils.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I'm curious, do you have a favorite color pattern or a favorite bumblebee?
Oh, yeah. So my favorite bumblebee of all time is Bombus aphipiatus, which is the species I studied for my master's and for my dissertation. I just really fell in love with it. But probably my favorite color pattern of all time is a bumblebee called Bombus rufofasciatus. Or fasciatus, which I've never seen in person because it lives in the Himalayan mountains and in Kashmir. But I've seen a dead one, and it has this amazing, gorgeous color pattern of oranges and yellows and whites and reds. And I just think it's like the most beautiful bee. And it's on like my bucket list to see it alive someday in the field.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, it seems like there are just so many really cool colors and patterns, and we'll have to put some pictures up to show our listeners what some of these bees look like. I think I want to shift into talking about conservation. I think that's something that our listeners will be really interested in. I guess I would be curious what scientists think are the most urgent questions to address relating to bumblebees.
Yeah, I think so. We've been having these meetings that we've been calling Bombus with two S's, so like the genus Bombus that bumblebees are in, but with two S's. And it stands for Building Our Methods with Sound Science. And it's this congress that we've been having with bumblebee researchers worldwide to figure out what are the important conservation issues that we as a community can identify to study bumblebees, and then also is there a way we can standardize some of the methods we're using to not only understand conservation issues, but also just basic fundamental science about bumblebees. And some of the areas that we've identified in terms of conservation for understanding bumblebees is that we really want to launch, at least for the United States, a national monitoring method for consistently surveying bumblebees in the wild across the United States and doing it every year to understand how their populations might be fluctuating. And that's now actually happening. Hollis Woodard, my postdoc advisor, is now heading up this national monitoring effort, which I think is really, really awesome. And so someday soon, the Fish and Wildlife and other government agencies and scientists, too, are going to work together to monitor bumblebee populations every year and see if we can identify specific regions where bumblebees need to be protected and conserved, and then also trying to identify maybe species, so not just geographic regions, but also particular species that we need to be working extra hard to conserve.
And how are scientists planning to do that?
So part of this grant that Hollis is leading up is trying to figure out what are the methods that we can do to do that. Most of what it probably will involve is people going out and collecting bees and identifying them and seeing what's out there, but doing it consistently on a regular basis and then doing it every year to see how those numbers might change.
Oh, okay.
And then in response to that, you know, we were also talking about, okay, so this national monitoring effort will help us figure out who's in trouble and where they're in trouble, but then how do we respond to that? And the Xerces Society is already doing, they're a conservation organization for conserving invertebrate species. They have a lot of really awesome materials for what individual people can do, what farmers can do, what scientists can do to help conserve bumblebees. And they have like specific planting guides for different parts of the U.S., like what flowers can you grow to help conserve bumblebees, what you can do in your own backyards, like leaving bare patches of ground that bees can dig into is actually really important, providing nesting materials for them.
Oh, just like dirt?
Yeah, yeah. So bees, well, not just bumblebees, but a lot of ground nesting bees, they don't like to dig through mulch. And it's actually very hard for them to dig through it. And so just having bare patches of ground that they can access and dig into is actually a great way to help them.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that was definitely something I was going to ask about, because I think a lot of people will have on their mind, like, if there's anything that they can do for bumblebees.
Yeah, that's one thing is, like, don't over manicure your yards. And do it in the name of conservation. So, not raking up leaves, because those leaves, the bees like to nest under leaf piles and grass piles, bumblebees specifically. Not over manicuring your lawn, because some of that's natural. Those natural elements that make a lawn maybe look a little untidy are actually very good for bees. And then the other thing is try to plant flowers that are going to bloom at different times of the year so that bees have a constant food source all year long.
Ah, okay. That makes sense. Yeah. So think about what the bees need, and you have an excuse to be a little bit lax on your yard work.
Yeah. And the Xerces Society actually has signs you can buy that lay your yard is pollinator habitat, so your neighbors don't get mad at you.
Yeah. So what are some of the questions that you're interested in studying next?
So my research program that I'm trying to build now at St. Vincent College is a little different than the heavy bumblebee focus that I used to have. So I'm at a small liberal arts college, but we actually have a very active research program with undergraduate students. And on a faculty of a biology department of 7 faculty, I'm the ecology and evolution expert. And so I'm not making all of my students study bumblebees. I don't want to force them to study bumblebees if they don't want to. But I encourage them to find something they're really interested in about, because I know they're going to have a stake in it and they'll do a really good job with the project. So all my students are doing ecology evolution related projects, and a lot of them have conservation applications, but they're not with bees. So I have one student who's going to start a project looking at the pathogens that are in bat poop. So my student, Sarah Maidment, she really loves bats and cares a lot about bat conservation. So what we're going to do is we're going to send these little guano collection kits to bat sanctuaries in Pennsylvania. And then we're going to try to sequence DNA of parasites and pathogens from their poop and see what's infecting bats locally in Pennsylvania. And then I have another student that's interested in looking at the effects of sunscreen on sea urchin development, which is not something I ever thought is not a project I ever thought I'd be involved in. Her name is Maggie Hines, and she's going to be studying how sunscreen pollution in marine environments affects sea urchin development. And then I have so these are all my junior students that are going to be starting their projects in the fall. And then I also have another student that's interested in surveying the parasites and pathogens inside of tick populations in Pennsylvania. So my student, Rachel Keller, is going to go out and catch and trap ticks. And then we're going to extract DNA from inside their bodies and see if they are carrying Lyme disease, but also other parasites inside them.
Ah, okay. I don't think I would want to go looking for ticks, but...
Yeah, we our very last lab that I have for my invertebrate zoology class was testing out these drag methods to see if we could catch ticks, which she was the only student in the class that was excited about it. So we just made these big canvas cloths, and you drag them over the ground, and then ticks will think it's like a deer or a person, and they'll jump onto the sheet. So we just drag these big cloths around, and we caught 3 deer ticks.
Wow. Doesn't sound like they're actually that hard to catch. Sounds like they want to be caught.
Especially in Western Pennsylvania, they're just they just kept popping onto the sheets.
What are you hoping to learn from that?
So we have a lot of, in Western Pennsylvania, at least at St. Vincent, I know so many people personally that have had Lyme disease. And so we're hoping to have a little better understanding, at least locally around campus, and then in other areas of Western Pennsylvania, what the presence of Lyme disease is in the tick population, but also just kind of understand what the ticks are that are even out there. We know we have deer ticks, but she also wants to study other species and whether or not they might be carrying potential bacteria that might pose a threat to human health. So Rachel specifically is interested in epidemiology. And so that's why she wanted to study insect-borne diseases.
Ah, okay. So one thing I also mentioned in the intro is that you're really into roller derby. And how have you sort of entwined that with your bee persona and love of bees and all of that?
So I was trying to come, everybody, well, not everyone, but a lot of people in roller derby have pseudonyms that they play under. Mine is Polly Nader. And that came up at a party, a roller derby party, at Joe Holly's house, where I was just talking endlessly and probably annoyingly about how much I love pollinators and bees. And somebody suggested, oh, that should be your roller derby name. You should be the Pollinator. And so that's where I got my name. And then I started to use Pollinator as a character to get kids to care about bees. So during National Pollinator Week, we'd have a farmer's market booth, and I would put on my roller skates that have bees on them. And then I'd dress up like a bee and skate around the farmer's market teaching kids about bees. And now I've added like a new like alter ego to roller derby. So everything in Pittsburgh that you might know is like everything here is black and yellow. All the sports teams, the Steelers, the Penguins, the Pirates, everybody's black and yellow, which I love. I don't really care about football or hockey or baseball, but I do love black and yellow because it's the color of bees. And so I use this opportunity to convince my roller derby team, whose colors are also black and yellow, that we should have a bee mascot. And so I bought this like giant fluffy bee costume, and during our games when I'm not playing roller derby, I put on the bee mascot costume and I answer audience questions about roller derby and or bees.
Oh, cool. What's the best question that you've gotten?
I mostly was just doing it to like mascot and run around, and then people just started asking me bee questions as like a joke, and I don't think they expected me to know the answers to them. So some guy in the audience was like, "Hey, Derby, does your stinger get pulled out when you sting people?" And I said, "No, it doesn't, because I'm a bumblebee, and bumblebees have smooth stingers so they don't get stuck and they can sting you multiple times. Honeybees have barbed stingers, and they're the ones whose stingers get stuck in you." And he was like, "Oh, I did not expect you to know anything about bees."
That's great. Actually, I didn't know that either. I didn't realize that bumblebees had smooth stingers, but they're pretty gentle, right?
Oh, yeah. They're really, like, I will go up to bees on flowers and pet them, because they really only will try to attack you if you end up on a nest and you've got guard bees that's their job is to protect the nest. And they might, so if you run over a colony with your lawnmower, you will probably get stung. Or if you try to squash one or catch it in a net, which is how I usually get stung.
How often do you get stung?
Very infrequently. People are surprised that I have not been stung more. Like, even working with live colonies where they do have those guard bees, as long as you're working with the red light, which they can't see, so they think it's complete darkness, they're very, very calm. So I think I've been studying bees for a decade, and I think I've probably been stung less than 100 times.
Whoa, you've been stung 100 times?
Well, less than 100. Less than. Yeah.
That still seems like a good bit.
Yeah, I guess that's, yeah, it's more than like an average person, but seems kind of like, I figured when I started on bees, I would be getting stung a lot more often than that.
Yeah, that makes sense. One last thing that I want to get to is, since we are all kind of sheltering in place during the COVID-19 pandemic, I'm wondering how this time, how not being at the lab and not being able to go out into the field, how this is affecting your research.
Well, I was supposed to go out to California this summer to help finish up my USDA NIFA project, but that's not happening anymore. A lot of samples that we've sent off for like sequencing of DNA, they're just kind of sitting again because those places have been closed because they're not considered essential. I'm teaching online now, which is like I've never done before in my life, but I'm trying to make my lecture videos really fun. Anybody can go on YouTube and watch my lecture videos for my general biology or my invertebrate zoology class, but they're a lot of work.
we'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Okay. I try to spice them up for my students, but like, you know, I really want to be at a liberal arts college because I love interacting and teaching students, and the huge part of my day, which was just letting students come in and talk to me and ask me questions, that's gone, and it's kind of depressing. I had a live bumblebee colony that was supposed to be shipped out the week this all started, and I had to call and cancel that. I was like, oh, I can't have bees in my house. Like, if I can't keep them at school, they're going to have to go in my house. I really don't want my guest room to become a bumblebee rearing room. So,
How do you rear a bumblebee colony in the lab?
So there are companies that will produce bumblebees for commercial pollination. So like if you are growing tomatoes or peppers or something like that in a greenhouse, one thing you can do to pollinate them is you can just use a tuning fork. So tomatoes, they have these things called poricidal anthers, which means they need to be buzzed and shaken like a salt shaker so the pollen will come out. And if they don't get that buzz, then they won't get pollinated. So one thing you can do is you can just grab a tuning fork.
Like one for music.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay.
I actually just ordered one for one of my students' projects. Yeah, you just like, you ring the tuning fork and it vibrates the flowers and the pollen comes out. And then you can use a paintbrush to pollinate the flowers. Or you can just get a colony of bumblebees and they'll do it for you.
Oh.
And so those companies also sell bumblebees to researchers. And so that's the most common way that people study bees in the lab.
Okay. But you would actually keep them inside?
Yeah. So they come in like 1 foot by 1 foot cardboard box. And you just keep them in that cardboard box. And then you can just, what also comes underneath them is like a big bag of sugar syrup that they can drink from. And then you can supplement it with pollen. So I have there's a standard pollen cookie recipe that bumblebee researchers use to make pollen patties for the bees to feed on.
Oh, that's not something I ever would have expected.
Yeah, so if you're studying bees in the lab, we usually feed them honeybee collected pollen. So if you've ever gone to a grocery store and seen bee pollen for sale, that's pollen that's been collected from honeybee colonies. So they'll put like this mesh on the entrance of the colony. So when the bees come in, it knocks the pollen off their legs and falls through. And then they collect those trays of pollen and then they sell it in grocery stores. So what bumblebee researchers do is we buy that honeybee collected pollen. And then we grind it up and mix it with sugar syrup and make like these kind of like pollen cookies that you can then put into the colony and feed to the bumblebees.
Oh, so you actually bake for your bees.
Yeah. And sometimes the experiment I was talking about where I fed two different types of flower pollen to the bumblebees, that was with queen bumblebees. And if you're trying to get a queen to start a colony and lay eggs, she needs a lot of pollen. But sometimes that pollen can go kind of stale. So what I would do is make these tiny little, maybe like the size of an M&M, like a peanut M&M. Oh. I'd make like a pollen ball. And then I would stick a toothpick in it and then dip it in beeswax so that it would stay fresh for her.
Oh, that's great. It's like a pollen popsicle.
Yeah. And then that keeps the wax, keeps the moisture in. And then she also can repurpose that honeybee beeswax to make cells in her new colony.
Oh, okay. Wow. There's a lot that goes into taking care of bees.
Yeah.
I think we're nearing the end of our time, but I have one last question for you. And I'd just like to know, what's the one thing that you'd want everyone to know about bumblebees?
Probably the most important thing would be that there's not just one species of bumblebees. There's at least 250 species of them, and that they live all over the world. And what else? Bumblebees can be really, really friendly. And unless you're trying to kill them, you really, really don't need to be afraid of them.
Yeah, that's a great thought to end on. Michelle, thanks so much for sharing about pollinators and also all this roller derby fun and raising bees. And thanks for being on the show.
Oh, yeah, no problem. I love preaching about the bees anytime I can.
Science for the People is listener supported. You can find us on Patreon, where you can support us with monthly donations in any amount. Your support keeps us afloat and able to keep making great new episodes, and we thank you for it. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders and edited by Ryan Bromsgrove. We get help with special projects from K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Bethany Brookshire, Anika Hazra, Marion Kilgour, and me, Rochelle Saunders.